Welcome to Between the Covers, a weekly KBOO program all about books and the people who write them. I'm your host this week, Ken Jones. On today's show, our guest is Karen Russell, author of the new book Orange World and Other Stories. Orange World is Karen's fourth book, following the novel Swamplandia, the novella Sleep Donation, and two collections of short fiction, St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves and Vampires in the Lemon Grove. Swamplandia was a finalist for the Pulitzer Prize, winner of the New York Public Library Young Lions Award, and one of the New York Times' 10 Best Books of 2011. Karen has received a MacArthur Fellowship, that's the famous genius grant, and a Guggenheim Award. She's currently the endowed chair of Texas State University's MFA program, where she teaches in the fall semesters. Karen was born and raised in Miami, Florida, now lives here in Portland. Her new hometown is an influence on at least two stories in the new collection. In the words of Louise Erdrich, Orange World is a feast of invention and a funhouse of surprising wisdom. The book contains a ghost ship lodge, tourist trade in a post-apocalyptic drowned city, a tornado farm, a local succubus. Karen Russell moves from the farcical to the forbidden with tender conviction. Don't miss this book of marvels. Karen Russell, welcome to KBOO.
Oh, thanks so much for having me, Ken.
Now, Karen, there's so much to talk about, and I told you earlier I cut probably about half the questions, so we wouldn't be here all afternoon. But let's get right to Orange World. Readers of short story collections often wonder whether there's a coherence to the stories, kind of like a concept album in music. Mm-hmm. This is your third book of fiction, and you said, quote, "It feels to me like my most coherent collection, in part because all of the stories arose from the same bedrock." What was that bedrock?
Oh, well, you know, in the past, I suppose it's been a little more diffuse. You know, the stories kind of range in time. And here they all came out of this sort of five-year period where I went from just bouncing around like a Mary Poppins from university to university, sort of doing these guest gigs. And yeah, and really sort of feeling like I just was maybe not a good candidate for the kind of sustained intimacy you would need to, you know, put down a root somewhere, settle with somebody. And then I found myself living here in Portland, where I met my now husband, and we fell in love. We had our son.
And that's Oscar.
Yeah.
There's another one on the way.
There's another one on the way. And I mean, this sounds like very banal and paraphrase, I keep thinking, but it was the most spectacular metamorphosis, you know, for me personally. And I think that often happens, right? I sort of think there's the title story in this collection tries to get at that a little bit, like something that is as common as bread, you know, like people have been having kids. That's how that's a very old story, right?
Oh,
not,
it's a wonderful
not a new
story,
genre.
Yes.
But for me, it really felt like entering some completely alien territory. So and that was a little bit how, you know, finding myself shifted on the grid and living here in Portland. And, you know, I guess the day to day, you know, that drama of duration, I was part of the bedrock. And then there's also just the stuff that we all know because we've all been living through it these last 5 years. It's been a time.
So the personal and the political.
So I think that was very disorienting to me, you know, to have sort of for the first time in my life, a permanent address, you know, the first time since Miami, you know, where I wasn't like forwarding mail like a grifter every 3 months. I mean, silverware and drawers, like these things all felt very miraculous to me. But then, you know, on the other hand, feeling like, oh my goodness, the world order felt, we saw that upended in some ways, you know, there's everyone's funneling the same anxieties about, you know, the like literal changes to our atmosphere, you know, sort of erosions to our democracy. You know, we're all, I think, living this moment that you see it called surreal all the time in the news, right? And it's happening at this velocity that I think can feel assaultive to a lot of people. So that is sort of there's a season of like extreme hope and extreme fear that produced a lot of the stories in this book.
All eight stories were written during this five-year period of that transformation.
Yes. Yeah. And a lot of them sort of deal in different ways with metamorphoses, you know, of various kinds. And you mentioned two of them, you know, sort of feature Portland. And that was
We'll talk about those.
Exciting
yes.
to me. Yeah. Just to see it show up in. That made me feel like, oh, maybe this place really is becoming my home.
Yeah. Now, let's talk about Portland. There, the two stories are one takes place in Southeast Portland,
right?
Lightly fictionalized Southeast Portland, which you live near there, And that's the story, Orange World, the title story. And then the first story in the book, The Prospectors, takes place near a fictionalized Mount Hood. You call it Mount Joy in the book. Much of your previous work, as you mentioned, was set in your home state of Florida. And the geographical location is very primary in your work, probably more so than any other aspect of the story. So I want to talk about one of the epigraphs. There's two epigraphs for the book in Orange World. This comes from the book Ghostly Matters by Avery Gordon. And it reads, "We need to know where we live in order to imagine living elsewhere. We need to imagine living elsewhere before we can live there." Why did you choose that quote?
Oh, I mean, Avery is a friend, and she's also one of the most brilliant people alive. So I paraphrase her now with hesitance. One of the reasons I love that quote is it sort of gets at the challenge of good fiction, right? I mean, even though you're telling people up front that this is a lie, right? You know, this is just make believe. This is just pretend. Obviously, if it's going to function at all, it has to reflect something that people know is true about, you know, their what human nature is like, maybe also what non-human nature is like. And so thinking about a story is almost like a funhouse mirror where you're going to encounter something, even if it's distorted, that's true about where you live. Try and understand a little bit about the reality of this place. And then out of that bedrock, then you start to make your alternate universe, maybe.
Yeah, I wanted to talk a little bit about the getting at the truth through what seems to be distortion, fiction, surrealism even in the stories. But first, let's get to the fictionalized Florida of the near future and the gondoliers. About the other stories, you said, "I often had done a little exploring in these locations that inspired the stories in Orange World. But unlike Swamplandia, these landscapes were foreign to me." So pretty much the landscapes in almost every story in the book other than the title story, or the gondoliers, I'm sorry. "A lot of my earlier work is set in a sort of mythical version of my own childhood backyard, which is Miami. Was it a bit terrifying, maybe exhilarating even, to leave that backyard? And how'd you go about getting acquainted with those new landscapes? You've got Nebraska in there. You've got 17th century Croatia. You've got the fictionalized Mount Hood in southeast Portland."
Oh, totally liberating. I love that question. I mean, I think it's sort of analogous to just leaving your hometown, right? I mean, I truly love South Florida. I spent so many years working on this novel, Swamplandia, that then it was just like, you know, gas up the car and let's go anywhere else. Like, I mean, I really was very ready to just jump around. And but it was it's difficult too, you know? I think in the way that a lot of writers, you'll feel them returning to childhood again and again, which makes sense to me because that was your Ur landscape, right? I mean, I think my husband, who grew up out here with totally different sight lines, you know, in Eugene and Portland, that the most real nouns to him are like sort of, you know, the rocks of the West. And I feel like the way about alligators that I'm sure some like Midwestern kid feels about, I don't know, like Angus cattle or something. I don't know, you know, but it's just that's your first references,
right?
You spend the most time with them. They have like kind of a different shimmer to them. So I think sort of then it is sort of difficult to say, well, how do I gather the authority to imagine my way into like a place like Nebraska, which to me, you know, might as well be the moon, like, you know. And
the Nebraska itself is very realistic in the story. The fact that the main character is a tornado farmer kind of adds a little bit of the surreal.
Yes. And so for me, that's the door usually. I think if I was trying to write a story that was a completely realistic take on Nebraska, you know, whatever that means really, because it's always kind of compression and distortion. But if I set out and I said, this is going to be my mimetic Nebraska, you know, in a story, I wouldn't know how to gain that authority to enter that world. So it's almost like the door for me sometimes has to be
the fantastic element.
Yes, exactly. And that's where it starts to feel like, okay, so now we're a few degrees shifted from consensus reality. You know, this is like a hypothetical Nebraska. It's still going to be tethered to this real place. It's still going to be a world of consequences. But it's not a story about, I'm going to transpose a story about some Nebraskan man who's, you know, watching kind of his way of life under attack, and he's, you know, in retirement. He's not raising cattle anymore.
And all that's in the story, except he's not raising cattle. It's tornadoes. It's storms.
Yeah. So, and I think that, you know, and similarly, I think a little bit with some of these other tales, like it would have been very possible, I suppose, for another writer to just to tell the story of new motherhood in a strictly realist way. It's already so strange, right? But I think because I didn't know how to get to the heart of that strangeness unless I went through the door of the fantastic, like we were saying. So then this devil shows up. And thank God, because I really felt like some of what I wanted to write about felt so private and hallucinatory that I needed to find another way into the story than just sort of like a diary of the weeks and months following the birth of my son. You know what I mean?
Yeah. And in fact, I told you before we sat down here that I listened to your two previous Between the Covers interviews with wonderful David Naiman. And in one, David mentioned a quote from your former teacher, Ben Marcus. I think it was something where if you're going to have a fantastical story, make just one thing fantastical and the rest is as real as possible, which I think you kind of adhered to.
I think that really, it was something like blue doesn't stand out on blue, you know, or something like almost like a Home Depot sort of a metaphor. And I mean, I can think off the top of my head of writers where they're operating in a different way, right? It's not necessarily sort of there is one dilation of reality and we just play it out like a hypo, you know, some counterfactual. But for some reason, for me, that constraint really helps me to sort of have a what would happen if kind of a premise and just spin it out. And that there's a lot of pleasure in that for me, too. Mm. Like kid pleasure a little bit, right?
I think that becomes very clear when reading this. I felt that pleasure, that delight when reading the stories. Let's continue on the title story, Orange World. Yeah. Most of the stories in the book are set in a fictionalized geographical landscape. The near future Florida and the Gondoliers, the Prospectors, that fictional Mount Hood, a Black Corfu, which is an island off the Croatian coast in the 17th century, or that's the setting of the story. But the landscape in Orange World takes place in a very realistic southeast Portland. The actual landscape, though, the Orange World itself is more of a psychological one. You have this description from the story. Orange World is a nest of tangled electrical cords and open drawers filled with steak knives. It's a baby's fat hand hovering over the blushing coils of a toaster oven. It's a crib purchased used. I just love reading your work out loud or to myself. I mean, it's just beautiful prose. How did you use that non-geographical landscape to shape the story and the characters? It's the only one quite like that in the book.
Yeah, thank you for that reading. It is. That felt a little different to me. In part because it was also, it overlapped with sort of this story that I was living, which has never happened for me before. Usually there's a lot more time has to elapse and I have, you know, processing time before I would try to, you know, nothing's ever directly autobiographical, but you know what I mean? Like you would, before something would sort of show up in a story. And this, I mean, I was really kind of in the weeds still when I started working on this story. And I think in some ways it's because that experience was so intense for me, and I writing is always where I figure out what I think or feel about anything, you know, like that famous Didion quote. But I will say, and I worry Ken's gonna get me in trouble, you guys, because he guessed like the actual physical inspiration for a lot of these places. There's the co-op that I actually do go to.
You call it Milk and Honey in the book, but it's the People's Food Co-op. You mentioned a piano store, which is right there near the Aladdin Theater off Powell. So I recognize some of
the... Yeah, so Ken could have, like, come up to my door and just knocked on it. I mean, he figured out, like, within a three-block radius sort of where I live from this story.
I didn't know that. So.
But that's, I mean, it helped me a little bit because I think that was sort of the... Like the underpinnings of this story do feel pretty realistic to me. And somehow I gave birth to our son during that winter that Portlanders will remember 2 years ago, where it was just like
snow was
epic
on the ground.
Snows.
Yes.
You really,
very
your
rare.
Your world, like for all of us, it was like someone drew the purse string shut. Everyone was living within this, you know, 10 block radius around their house. So it already felt like a pretty self-enclosed time, you know?
Oh, that makes sense, because in the book, first of all, maybe we should say that the lead character, Ray, makes a deal with somebody she thinks is the devil, or it could be just a large rodent. We're not really sure of the story, to protect her baby who might be in danger. And she goes out to breastfeed the demon at around 4:30 in the morning, and it's often icy there. And in fact, she's afraid she's going to slip and all that. So I didn't catch the actual that weather pattern, but that's true. 2 years ago, we had all that snow and ice.
It was really extreme, and I think something about that was like a unusual at minimum, right? To like look out your window and like everyone is a paleontologist of their car, like hacking it out of the ice, and there was such a huge snow dump. I mean, I've never seen Portland look like that before or since. So. It was so funny to, like, you know, come home with this new baby. Already you suddenly feel like in one extraordinary detonation, like your whole the whole landscape of your life has transformed. And then, like, the literal landscape is unrecognizable, you know? And I think that was an interesting that heightened whatever felt kind of, you know, surreal and insane and amazing for me about those early weeks. So drawing on some of that. And then the part, you know, having the one sort of supernatural or fantastic element being that, as you mentioned, this mother has been sort of hoodwinked by this like little huckster demon into a deal where she has to breastfeed him every night in this gutter in exchange for like the protection of her son. So that's the cycle that she's sort of established.
Did the story start with your pregnancy, or did it start with thinking of the demon, or maybe conjoining those two?
Tough for me to source now. That's a very, there's a lot of margarine on the lens there for me looking back.
Because you had a lot of real experience. You had the neighborhood, you had the weather event, you had the pregnancy.
Yeah.
And then the supernatural, the surreal part of it is the demon enters.
Yeah. I think, I mean, the real honest answer is like, this is not, you know, a unique story by any means, but we had this sort of very scary stretch in the pregnancy that, you know, I had never felt in my life that kind of animal pleading before. But I think that this is not exclusive to pregnant women. I mean, everyone alive, I think, who has loved anyone has, you know, that the way that the whole world can kind of turn on a dime and suddenly you are just begging with all the cells in your body, you know, please, please, please.
I'll do anything.
You don't even know to what you're sending that message out into the universe. You know, you would give anything for the luxury of your old anxieties, right? You're like, oh, man, just, you know, Wednesday, what was I complaining about? Wednesday was great.
Traffic was bad. but now my baby's in danger.
Right, or my mother, or my son, you know, whatever. That sort of, you're ready to sort of make crazy promises, right? You're like, I'll never ask for anything again, you know. So I think that was the state that, having the devil show up, it just gave me a way. In some ways, I wanted to kind of literalize like what that really feels like and what that kind of fear can lead people to do, right? Which is not always in anybody's best interest.
Listeners might think that there's a lot of kind of the supernatural horror in here, but this story especially is extremely funny. There's a lot of funny dialogue. There's a lot of funny kind of almost slapstick type physical humor when she gets some help from her new mom's club. I'm laughing just thinking about it. It was a very funny story. Karen, you're often typed as a fabulist. I know most writers really don't like categorizations like that, but there's writers you admire who have the same categorization. George Saunders, Kelly Link, Helen Oyeyemi, your former teacher, Ben Marcus, and many of the stories in the book read almost like fables or fairy tales. And I know you've mentioned the Brothers Grimm in the past as an influence on your work. In fact, the fourth story in the book, The Prospectors, I can describe it as The Shining meets Jack and the Beanstalk.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And in the story, The Bad Graft, you actually write, and this is right from the story, and hadn't their trip unfolded like a fairy tale?
Mm-hmm.
Is that a conscious influence for you, fairy tales?
Oh, I think definitely. And I think particularly with that line, you know, hadn't their trip unfolded like a fairy tale? The template for so much of the way we think about our lives comes from those old stories, right? I mean, my son is two now, but you see the way that almost osmotically those stories get into you as a kid. And that's sort of another one of your reference points, right?
Oh, exactly.
I mean, even if it's like via like watered down Disney version, but those stories are inside all of us, you know?
Yeah, I wanted to tell you about that. I did a Between the Covers interview about a year ago with a writer named Todd Davies, who lives in Ashland. She is the author of this fantasy series called History of Arcadia. and it's a fantasy for grown-ups. But she told me fairy tales talk about who we really are. Fairy tales are really true, and they're important.
Yeah.
Fairy tales are not just little kids' stories or children's stories or things to be exploited by Walt Disney. I kept that in mind when I read a quote from, well, actually it was a quote that you quoted Flannery O'Connor. Mm-hmm. And that quote from Flannery O'Connor, by way of Karen Russell, the truth is not distorted here, but rather a distortion is used to get at truth. Do you use fairy tales in a way to get at that truth that you can't get at with, say, a true story about a farmer, a cattle farmer, rancher in Nebraska?
I think absolutely. And I mean, I love that quote just for its elegance. It feels almost mathematical way she constructed it.
Yes, it's like a formula.
Isn't it? Yeah. And also, I think for me, too, it helps me sometimes to sort of understand, you know, why ghosts and devils keep showing up in my
work.
Yeah, because I think it reminds you that you're connected to this lineage of stories. You know, we didn't come from nowhere. I mean, there is this deep repository of stories that humans have used to kind of understand their strange predicaments here for a very long time.
Oh,
and I'm
yes.
sure that's why children love fairy tales. There's a truth inside them. It's, you know, it's not straightforward. It's not easily paraphrasable. It's not like within, you know, the neatness of some moral that can cheapen, you know.
I wanted to talk about that. But first, I had a little later here a quote from your friend, Avery Gordon, again from her book, Ghostly Matters. And it's actually not a quote from her, but it's from, I looked up the book because I hadn't heard of it.
That's
and
great.
There was an article in the journal Sociology Lens. The review writes, Gordon argues that ghostly matters, the name of the book, are signifiers of what is missing and what must be examined. And that connected with something I read in an interview you gave about 6 years ago. You said, and I just think that's when the ghost comes back, right? When there needs to be a reckoning with the past or when there's something to be done or a little joke, there's a really shallow burial that didn't function. And you have ghosts very clearly in The Prospectors. They're from Depression era CCC workers, Civilian Conservation Corps, and The Walking Dead in Black Corfu. How would you apply, in other words, this insight into Avery Gordon's book to your work?
Yeah, I loved finding this book. I think it's been a real inspiration for, you know, well outside kind of academic walls. I think a lot of artists love Avery's work. And this is, again, the book's called Ghostly Matters, Haunting in the Sociological Imagination. But it just gave me kind of a new way to understand, again, why my what I was haunted by, you know, why these sort of scepters kept kind of turning up in things I was writing. And what's interesting, you know, a lot about her work to me is a lot of people think about a haunting as something exclusively negative, right? Like if you saw a ghost in your house, it wouldn't be a great day. You know, you'd be sort of bummed about
out.
It.
Yeah,
yeah. You'd be like, well,
yeah.
Right. You're not like necessarily, yeah, you're screaming or you're calling, you know, an exorcist or you're...
No, it's almost always frightening.
Or you know, Carmen Maria Machado has a wonderful ghost story where the twist is just like these people cannot afford to break their lease. So they're like, you know, it kind of gets...
Stuck.
Yeah, they're really stuck there. It's just like kind of like a real estate horror story. But Avery has this notion that it's like, no, you know, if a ghost represents something to be done, you know, something is out of equilibrium, some force of containment or repression is no longer holding, but now you have this opportunity to discover kind of what is out of whack, you know, or, you know, something is coming to life, not just to light, and you have this opportunity. And I don't think most people, to include myself, necessarily think of a ghost as an opportunity. Or,
but
you know,
definitely The Prospectors, I think the two main characters, one has the name Eggplant, Aubergine, and her friend, and they meet these ghosts, and it seems like it's something that was necessary for them.
Yes.
And they had some insights about their relationship based on meeting these ghosts and spending the night with them and trying to get down the mountain again in the morning.
Yeah. Juno Diaz has a really beautiful piece, actually, about apocalypse as revelation. Again, you know, that's not a word with a lot of positive connotations, but just the revelatory power of something that feels quite apocalyptic. And this was a story about these these poor workers who are killed by this avalanche, and they are sort of the last to know. They're sort of
they're having a great party.
Yeah, it's they're having a, like high times up on this mountain, and these young women, you know, take the wrong ski lift and wind up at just. I think like even if you know, you haven't found yourself at a party where you're the only living people. Maybe we've all felt that way before. You've just,
well, you don't know
anybody. You took the
else.
Wrong vehicle to the wrong party. Yeah, yeah, exactly. You're like, oh no, this was a big mistake.
Right. I've got to get out of here.
I am in the wrong story. Yeah, I've been miscast in this play. So I think it was also a little bit for me about, you know, these women really, in a funny way, funny to me, but also it felt kind of connected to, you know, the real world dynamics that many people have experienced, I think, women particularly, where they wind up propping up this entire ghostly infrastructure, you know, pretending to believe that these men are alive, pretending to believe that they're in this fantastic lodge, you know, to survive, you know, and then the stakes are that, you know, these existential stakes exist where they have to sort of mute a certain kind of knowledge that would, you know, undo this structure
and
prop up
these
egos. Yeah. And there was something really funny and really sad to me about that idea. And then it did become in a funny way also this story about these women's friendship. So there's a little bit of a fairy tale shimmer at the ending there that was mysterious to me.
Yes.
Even.
So I wanted to get back to that because you mentioned before the way your stories differ from fairy tales is you'll have more of an ambivalent ending. There won't be a nicely wrapped up moral or a lesson in life to learn. It seems more true to life to me than what a fairy tale would do. So to go to that story, the prospectors in the fairy tale Jack and the Beanstalk, which I described as The Shining meets Jack and the Beanstalk, Jack climbs down from the giant's home in the sky with a goose that lays golden eggs. And he and his mom finally get out of poverty. You know, that helps him a lot. So I guess the lesson is, you know, follow your dreams and you'll be a rich person. You know, he went up the beanstalk. But in this story, the two women, they make it down from this ghostly lodge and they take a mysterious yellow bird. And I'm not really sure why they took the bird, what it does for them. Is that your way of staying closer to the truth? I mean, I don't think there really is an answer to that. Maybe you have it, but I don't think the reader can get to that.
Yeah, I am. And I'll say, too, I mean, just because I've been revisiting the Grimm's anthology recently, so many of those fairy tales are quite dark. And I think sometimes I think it's sort of we have these bolderized versions for kids where...
Yes,
you know,
the Disney version.
The Disney version, yeah. Right, where it's like, yeah, there is, you know, it's like, well, if you just, or like Frozen, right, where there is some kind of very easy to grasp connection between like one's character and the outcome of the story, right, or it's like goodness is rewarded. And what I sort of think I loved as a kid about some of these Grimm's fairy tales, there would be no real psychological correspondence between like who these characters were and what was happening to them. It would just be like out of the blue sky, an eagle came down and snatched your sister for no reason that you can intuit. And now your widower father has sold you to a bear. Like, I mean, it would just, you know, they got it sort of this like very arbitrary fortune too. And I think as kids, you're so aware of that. You're like, but you know, it doesn't seem like actually there's a much of a correlation in this life between one's personal goodness and how the story goes, you know? And so kids know that, right? They sort of know,
oh, yes.
Like you don't always make it down the beanstalk with the gold, you know, and you're saved from poverty. Like sometimes.
I don't think that ever happens.
right. And I think, so there is that sort of... there's something amazing about the terrifying honesty in some of these stories, too, that I think kids are drawn to, where they're like, oh, doesn't really seem fair that younger brother, you know, got
eaten. And...
Right. Exactly.
But hey, that's life.
That's just what, unfortunately.
It can happen to you. I guess you don't want to give kids that message.
Right. Where it's like, oh man, like that, you know, it's a bummer that like we had to eat mom in that soup, but that's just how today went.
We were hungry.
Right. So something about, there's honesty without apology or explanation in some of these darker stories. I think that image feels as open, the this decide. So these women, not to give it all away, but they do wind up escaping from at least one kind of apocalypse. And that in some ways is more positive than many of the other endings I've ever written. But on their way out of this sort of palace of death, you know, it's almost like if you inverted an underworld journey and you went to a ghost world at the top of the mountain, you know, instead of sort of Persephone descending, these women take a ski lift up to this ghost party. So they end up sort of making it back to the realm of the living. And on their way out, they see this bird that's shrieking at the top of its lungs. And it's saturated with color. It's so much more real than anything else in this phantom lodge. And they know right away, this is as alive as we are, this golden bird. I think something about, you know, gold sort of has this multivalent meaning inside the story.
The ghosts have golden eyes.
They've got golden eyes. These women are sort of gold diggers in like a real literal way. Right. You know, there's they were sort of drawn to the West by this idea of the gold rush, like this old, this American mythology, really. You know, this dream of like going from rags to riches in one afternoon of panning. And then, you know, this is all happening during the time of the Great Depression. So something about what gold signifies for us, you know. Then there's also just this luminous, like, solar life, like, spilling over the borders of this tiny bird, like, spilling out of its mouth. And I think for me, but I also hesitate to even say this because I feel like it is truly mysterious to me still why that bird showed up. So I go back and forth. But what felt right to me intuitively about it was just this idea of, like, yeah, they're not leaving with any real treasure to speak of, right? I mean, they're escaping with their lives, but that's not nothing.
No.
You know, I mean, that's everything.
I really don't think we've ruined it by talking about, because I think everybody will get a certain experience from the ending. There is an ambivalence there where you can fill in based on your own personality, your own take on the story. This is just ours or mine.
I always love, though, you know, in those, like, in Gilgamesh, right, where it's like, what can you bring back from the world of the dead? Not what you went in for, usually, right? People
right.
aren't like, oh, I mean, with some exceptions, but you're not sort of bringing back eternal life or your lost loved one even, you know, but maybe they have like this... Maybe they have this song that they're taking back down the mountain. Maybe they have this golden feather that is, you know, just a reminder, you know, that they, all right, we escaped with our lives. And that's not nothing. That's everything.
Now, Orange World is your third collection of stories. And you've said, quote, stories feel special to me because each can become a kind of universe in miniature. As a kid, I loved snow globes. My sister does too. And museum dioramas, maybe for the same reason. I also think stories can haunt you in a very particular way, their velocity and their compactness. I always have the sense, too, with my favorite stories, that the world of the story is still spinning somewhere long after I finish the last page. Because of a story's brevity, you can almost hold it in the palm of your hand. You can walk around its periphery. It stays with you in a different way, I think, than a novel. A story can work on you almost like a poem. You read it in one sustained burst, and it has a different kind of integrity inside you, which I find as a reader of your stories. But does this apply to your writing the stories as well as being a reader of other people's stories?
Oh my God, I so wish. And I also should say, hearing that, hearing you read that, I feel like I'm compelled to tell listeners, these stories are long as hell. Like, I feel like you might not, you know, I forgive anybody who needs to take a break to eat a sandwich and then returns to read these stories.
Oh, no, that's not true, Karen.
They're the 40 really
pages,
long.
I don't think you're going to be able, I don't think you're going to want to leave and eat a sandwich in
but
the middle of
it. But I love reading. I do really, if it's possible, that's my preferred way to read a story, is just to go from beginning to end and just kind of parachute into that world and stay there. And there is something about the experience of reading something in one sustained burst. I do just find you sort of like, it's almost like a dream returning to your body or something. You have it kind of whole cloth, you know?
Right.
And that's not always my, I mean, novels take me forever to read. I'm a very slow reader. So I'll have just a more fragmented memory of them for some reason. But I wish it would be my dream to, like, I hear this happens to other people where they sit down and they're like, a voice went blazing through me and I finished the story that afternoon and like high-fived myself and, you know, I don't know, like,
wow,
went out for drinks. That's never been my experience. I have never like
I've heard
sat down on fire, you know, and just sort of a story pours out of me, and then I'm spent, and I'm like so exhilarated. It's
but it would great be great.
Wouldn't
if
that
it
be
happened?
Great? Yes. Oh my god, that is truly my dream. I would love. I invite any ghost to come and like possess me and just like fly over the keyboard. And then I get to go out to dinner, and I'm like, cool, I wrote a story.
I just need 7 more, and I have
right.
a book.
Yeah. Right, yeah, exactly.
Be published next week.
Yeah, right. I'm going to be laughing all the way to the bank.
Now, your novel Swamplandia was an expanded take on one of your early stories, Ava Wrestles the Alligator, and that was in the first collection, St. Lucy's Home for Girls Raised by Wolves. In Orange World, the story The Gondoliers creates an entire post-apocalyptic world in about 40 pages, which I don't think is that long. It seems like it could have been a novel. If you could just kind of play along for a little, if so, what would you expand on? And to make it a short story, what did you leave out to get it to that length?
Yeah, that's a great
question.
So I
guess it kind of is a specific reply on the difference between writing a novel and a short story.
Yeah, and I feel uniquely equipped to answer this question because I once made the mistake. I had written this like 12-page story about these two sisters at an alligator wrestling park. And those people, you know, they just continue to haunt me. And this was sort of my delusion where I was like, I'll be done. Wow, this story keeps growing. Now it's 40 pages. I'll probably be done with a novel this summer. And, you know, and it took 5 years. And so I think it just felt like trying to play the accordion badly, you know. Like it just didn't. That was my mistake. I think was thinking
that
it would be.
But you became obsessed with the setting and the characters.
I became obsessed. So that hasn't necessarily happened for me with these sisters and the Gondoliers. Even though I had such a lot of the work of revision was kind of paring back, more exploratory sections where I just wanted to be in that world for a while, kind of poling around. There wasn't anything totally urgent happening. I was just sort of like, I wonder what's over here behind the wrecked cruise liner. You know, I wonder what it looks like on the roof of the sunken library. But it was,
almost
you know,
like
it,
a video game.
Almost, like a... I mean, yeah, a little bit in the sense that, but you know how if you had a video game where there were no stakes, you know, you would, I mean, that's the one that I would play actually, where you just kind of wander around like picking flowers. But I feel that most people prefer some kind of imperative or problem, you know, that they're not just like, hey,
kill the bad guys, get the
gold.
Yeah,
unfortunately,
kind of
it seems like that. But I want the one where you just sort of like swim in some infinite grotto and you're like, what's over here?
But you were world building. You've talked several times in past interviews about your admiration for Frank Herbert's Dune.
Yes, I love
and the world building he does in that book. And yet in 40 pages, you built a whole world here. I mean, it was extremely convincing.
Oh, I'm so glad, Ken. I'm really glad because it has that kind of, it feels expansive in my mind. I think if it was going to become a novel, right, I suppose, you know, they're these four sisters, you know, you really...
Explore their relationships.
You would learn a little bit more about this kind of strange, you know, nouveau Venetian family business they're running where they pull people around the drowned canals of this old city in Florida.
And their attraction to this dead spot.
Yes,
it's funny because the very next day after I read the story, we did a story on the news here about this huge dead zone in the Gulf of Mexico, the biggest ever. And it's caused by pretty much the same thing. A fertilizer gets in there, and I guess
it's
a
terrifying.
Big area
it becomes
of the
kind of
sea is dead.
Hypoxia
exactly.
It's terrifying to me, you know.
And here you had that in your futuristic Florida, New Florida, you call it in the story.
Yeah, I mean, I think also sort of thinking a little bit about the tension between everybody's awareness right now that we have this unique status as the species that creates these dead spots. You know,
right.
It's the way we're you know, just modifying the planet at this alarming rate. And the idea of like, you know, that I mean, coral reef, that story is so heartbreaking to me somehow. Sort of like the coral reef giving us like the bird, you know, in the form of this like white ghostly finger. It's like, what are you guys doing? Or just the idea of like a lifeless ocean, like the cemetery ocean is what could be more terrifying. But I also sort of, in this story especially, was thinking about, you know, if you have something that looks like a wasteland, very possibly it's also this rookery where something new is going to be born, you know, like some new space might also open up. I think I was thinking about Florida's, you know, earlier history where like the swamp was really perceived as this total wasteland.
Yeah, I read it really didn't take off until air conditioning, where the New Yorkers all moved down.
Well, unfortunately, right? But even, you know, there was this perception that, oh my God, this is a profitless nowhere, when of course that, you know, then you're sort of missing the whole story.
And the main character, the gondolier, Blister is her nickname. She is very hopeful, and this is her home. So she's adapted to it, and she doesn't feel it's the end of the world.
At all,
like,
right?
Like the passenger that she picks up,
right,
who's a much older person.
Right, and I think that would be, you know, if you were going to expand this, which I feel like pretty content to leave it at this frightening, exciting threshold for these women. But I do sort of think that would be, it would be interesting to extend things and see, like, what do humans become? What are these sisters who can echolocate and sort of chorus together and think together, and they start to get these sort of transmissions even from other species, other worlds,
They're
right?
adapting. They've been transformed to adapt
right.
to this
so
world.
So what are these, like, these mutant women, like, what does that start to look like for them? You know, how does the map of reality change for them if instead of operating as these sort of you know, discrete contractors, right? Where you're just in the tiny kingdom of your skull, you know, you sort of things start to get a little more watery and expansive for these ladies. And so I wonder what that would look like.
But I know you're not going to turn that into a novel, but you have been working on a novel. You've mentioned that it's a historical, fantastical novel about the Dust Bowl era, going back at least 10 years from the interviews I've read.
Ken, will you finish it for me? What do you,
I'd be a,
do you
it'd be a pleasure, but
time?
I think it would be unpublishable, I think. But I just wanted an update on that, the status. Obviously, you're still working on it.
I am still working on it, like a fool. I am. I mean, I really am hopeful, actually, that it won't take me, you know, another half decade to find my way through. You know, the tricky challenge of that project is it had just been around for so long. And I've worked on it, like, you know, intermittently. Mm-hmm. If I'm in story world, I'm sort of not usually working on this novel. That
but
I've
there's
just
some
been...
intersection, like with The Prospectors, which takes place during the Depression.
Yeah. Yes, exactly. So it's funny, right? I mean, it casts up these little tendrils, or even, you know, Tornado Auction, which is set in the Sand Hills of Nebraska.
Right.
There's still some magnetic strip there that keeps pulling me back. But I think that the funny thing is that some of what was interesting to me when I first came up with this idea now feels moribund. You know, I feel like the world has changed so much and I've changed a lot. So it's just sort of like if you felt like you were locked out of your house and had to jimmy open a window or something. You know, like, I think that is my predicament.
You're locked
predicament.
Out of your novel.
Yeah, I felt like I totally did feel that way, though. I had my son. And I was like, oh, I tried to return. And I was like, oh, no, like. Just looking through all the half-finished furniture through the windows. And
please break back in.
I've got to break back in.
We'd love to see that novel.
Yeah.
I'd love to read it.
So that's what I'm trying to do now. And, like, it's not pretty, but I just kind of had to smash my way back in there and finish things up.
Now, one last question, and it's really more kind of an announcement, I guess. Tonight you'll be, and you said you were a little nervous about it because it's live.
Yes.
And you'll be on OPB's Live Wire show. You'll be at the Alberto Rose Theater. The show starts at 8 o'clock. And you're not the only guest, and there's a moderator there, and there's a band. I think you'll do fine. You're extremely funny and charming. You're everything that LiveWire likes
and
radio likes. Did you have anything special planned for that, other than trying to not?
Other than trying to find clothes that still fit me. I mean, that's the next challenge of the day. I feel like one of the other nice things about Portland is, you know, I feel like I can unselfconsciously wear, you know, just a. Newspaper, you know, just leggings and
nobody
you
know, will
notice. No, everyone's fine.
We've got unipipers here, Darth Vader unipipers. So.
I would have to do a lot, right? I'd have to show up. If I showed up, you know, in a cape on a unicycle, everyone would still be like, whatever. That's just par for the course.
That's just the second one.
Well, I'm really excited because, you know, W. Kamau Bell is on the show, Franny Choi, this amazing poet. I mean, I feel like there's going to be, you know, charm and brilliance galore. So maybe the pressure's off that way. But you have to know that, like, for an introvert who just chose as a profession to take dictation from ghosts, like, this is a very strange. I feel grateful to be on LiveWire, but it is very. If you decided that you would just keep revising, you know, one sentence from an imaginary friend for most of your day to suddenly be on stage with anyone is a big kind of zero
really
to 60.
That's not really entertaining to watch.
No, it's no, very hard to dramatize. Yes. Right. So we'll see how it goes.
You'll figure something out. Well, Karen Russell, it's been a delight for me. Thanks very much for joining us here on Between the Covers.
Me too. Thanks, Ken. Thanks so much.
We've been talking with Karen Russell, author of the new collection of short fiction, Orange World, and Other Stories. Karen will be a guest on OPB's Live Wire tonight, June 13th, at the Alberta Rose Theater in Portland. You can get the details and buy tickets at livewireradio.org, and you can learn more about Karen and her work at karenrussellauthor.com. I'm Ken Jones, and this has been Between the Covers on KBOO Community Radio. Many thanks to Karen for visiting us at KBOO, and to all of you for listening. Tell me, honey,